Rania.
Yes, I are Jason. This is us here in the place just cooling out at CKUT 90.3 in Montreal.
C-Cut for the people, them.
Keeping it live.
Funk not only moves, it removes.
We talk about a gender pay gap in Canada, but did you know that there are gender pay gaps, plural? I'm Andrea Gunratch from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Equal Pay Day in Ontario was marked on April the 4th. It's symbolic of how far into the next year the average woman works to have earned what the average man earned in the previous year. In Canada, women make 88 cents for every dollar men make. But there's more than one gender pay gap because those who face gender inequalities are a diverse population. Racialized women make 87 cents to the dollar for racialized men. Indigenous women make 85 cents to the dollar for Indigenous men. Newcomer women make 87 cents to the dollar for newcomer men, and women with disabilities also have lower average incomes compared to men with disabilities. We would be wise to think of it as gender pay gaps, plural. Canada has had pay equity laws since the 1970s, but pay gaps and unfairness in pay still persist. They have huge lifetime impacts. Girls face a summer job gender pay gap of almost $3 per hour. Women post-secondary students leave school with lesser means to pay off student loans. And the gendered pension gap means women retire with about 80% of the pension men retire with. Hadia Rodrigue joins us to address gender pay gaps, their impacts on Black and equity-seeking women, how bias plays out in workplaces, and what we need to do about it. Hadia is a writer, cultural critic, speaker, researcher, lawyer, and consultant. Her work has appeared in The Walrus, Maclean's, The Toronto Star, and more. She's winner of the National Magazine Award for the Best Short Feature for Black in the Ivory. And she's best known for Black on Bay Street, a cover story for the Globe and Mail on her experiences in a Bay Street law firm. Hadia's consulting work focuses on workplace equity, diversity, and inclusion. She's an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Toronto, Scarborough.
I am a lot of things. I wear a lot of hats. Journalist, writer, professor, speaker, consultant, former dancer, singer. So I'm currently an assistant professor of journalism and journalism practice at the University of Toronto Scarborough campus. And my research centers around the use of sexist and racist discourses in the news, the impact of these discourses on readers, and the work experiences of racialized journalists. So I'm the former host of Canon Land's Commons. In 2021, I won the National Magazine Award for Best Short Feature for a piece I wrote called Black in the Ivory. I'm also a speaker and consultant who advises on DE&I issues in the workplace, but I am probably best known for my piece Black on Bay Street, which outlines my experiences as a young Black woman working in the primarily white Bay Street environment. And these experiences inform a lot of the consulting work I do, the writing work I do, and the volunteerism that I do as well. I am incredibly competitive. I do not like losing. And I also perform better with an audience. So I am a Leo, Sun, Moon, all of the Leo. And in university, when I was playing Ultimate Frisbee, my nickname was Show Dog because I would perform better, but people showed up to watch us on the sideline. All of a sudden, it would be like TSN turning point. I would be diving for things in a way that I had not been doing before. So that was my nickname as a young Ultimate Frisbee player. And it's something that continued throughout my career. I play better when I'm on a big stage and when people are watching. And I think I also carry that into other domains of my life as well. I'm also, I like to say, the world's best aunt. I have two twin nieces who are the joy and light of my lives. They are 14 months. There are no cuter humans on this planet than my nieces, and I will fight you if you try to tell me differently. But they said my name before they said mama, because Dee Dee is easier to say than mama. Anytime, I call them twice a day, every day. So now when my sister picks up the phone or someone calls on the phone, they say Dee Dee, because they think everybody on the phone is Dee Dee.
Tell us about the gender pay gap and gender pay gaps. What's behind them? How does it impact people differently, like Black women and racialized women?
I mean, the pay gap will depend on what you measure. Are you measuring hourly wages? Are you measuring annual wages? What are you controlling for? For example, that women are more likely to be employed part-time. But regardless of what you do, there is a significant pay gap for racialized groups as compared to white individuals. Some recent StatsCan data shows that Indigenous women face a 57% pay gap, immigrant women a 39% pay gap, if you're a woman with disabilities, 46% pay gap, racialized women a 32% pay gap. Gender pay gap is everywhere, but it targets women in sort of different racial categories in different ways. And the reason it affects Black women in a different way than it affects white women is because of intersectionality, which recognizes sort of the interconnected nature of different social categorizations, so race, class, gender, etc., creating overlapping and interdependent systems of discrimination or advantage. It recognizes that some of our identity markers, you know, woman, Black, do not exist independently of each other. I am treated differently in the workplace than my Black male counterparts. And so Black women face this double jeopardy, both of race and gender. To me, this really comes down to both the devaluation of women's work and the devaluation of Black people's work. At its core, this is about talent and who we perceive as talented, who we perceive as competent. You know, looking back at gender, let's take race out of it for a moment. Women are 58% of university grads in Canada. And I'll pick on my own former profession of the law. So law school graduation rates have been the gender binary, women and men, 50-50 for about 25 years. What do we see at the top of any large law firm in Canada? It's certainly not 50-50. If they're doing well, maybe it's 70-30. If they're not doing so well, maybe 80-20, 90-10. And so for us to believe that that makes any sense would mean that you think that men are smarter than women. I can tell you, replacing women 3 through 5 with men 6 through 8 is going to be a talent downgrade, right? Women outperform men in university. We actually outnumber men typically on the dean's list 2 to 1. For anyone to believe that the partnership and C-suites and judiciary represent the best of who we have in our country would mean that you think talent and intelligence are unequally distributed amongst genders and amongst races. Somehow you would have to believe that men get some sort of magical injection of talent around age 25, 26, 27 that us women don't get. And then when we put race back into that equation, I heard Trevor Noah say something quite insightful when he was on The Daily Show. Black people are looking for equality, not charity. We're not asking people to hire Black people or pay Black people just because they're Black. We're asking companies to stop not hiring Black people and to stop not paying Black people just because they're Black, because that's actually what's happening. There's a few patterns that drive it, and I want to talk about two in particular. So there's the prove it again bias, and then there's a tightrope of behaviors. Prove it again bias is where groups that are stereotyped as less competent often have to prove themselves over and over and over. They're not given the same benefits of doubts and sort of hand waving and saying, oh, they're just learning, it's no big deal. They make a mistake and it's held against them. You hear things like, oh, he'll crush it versus she's not ready for two people who have the same level of preparation. Prove it again groups are judged on performance. Others are judged on this mythical potential, which is usually, you'll look like me and I'm good, so therefore you must be good. You hear things like, oh, he's very talented versus, oh, you know, she got lucky. Or, you know, someone makes a mistake. Ah, that could happen to anyone. Versus, oh, you know, she really blew it. So that's where you have proven again groups' mistakes tending to be noticed more, remembered longer, whereas majority men's mistakes tend to be written off. There was a professor named Lauren Rivera at Northwestern University. She sat in on a bunch of consulting and banking interviews, which usually involves some sort of math component. And she found that whenever a man made a math mistake, a white man, oh, that was just a rounding error. Oh, he just missed a zero. Oh, that's like not a big deal. But anytime a woman or a person of color made that same mistake, it was often used as a thing that held them from getting to the second round. There's also the tightrope of behavior. And this is where a narrower range of workplace behavior is often accepted from women and people of color. So is someone a leader or are they a worker bee? Because if you're in a tightrope group, the expectation is you face this pressure to put your head down, not rock the boat, get your work done, and be undemanding and work hard. But then if you comply, you somehow now lack this mythical leadership potential that you're supposed to demonstrate. Or in who gets the office work and the glamour work? So people in tightrope groups often report less access to career-enhancing opportunities and a lot more office housework. Shiny new case, do you give it to the person who looks like you or do you give it to the Black woman? And more often than not, it's given to the person that looks like you.
Let's pause here. Hadiya's insight around the prove it again bias and tightrope of behavior illustrates how gender pay gaps aren't just a matter of equal pay for equal work. Equal pay for equal work is the easy conversation. You don't hear many people arguing that workers doing the same jobs shouldn't be compensated in the same ways. But gender pay gaps are more complicated. They happen not only because of discrimination, but also because women's work tends to get undervalued and underprotected, and women are expected to do a lot of work for free, like childcare and elder care. Gender pay gaps are also related to an array of opportunity gaps that come from all kinds of stereotypes and biases that are intended, unintended, and an uncomfortable mix of the two we don't often talk about.
And I remember having a partner, I was giving a talk. He said, well, you know, if I've given this to this young man and he's done a good job and another one comes up, I want to, you know, go back to him. And I'm saying, well, what happens if he leaves tomorrow? And you haven't given that opportunity to anyone else. And also, how do you know she won't do a better job? And then thirdly, why did you go to him first? Got really awkward after that. We all know the answer. They went to the person that made them more comfortable. A lot of these patterns are driving these differences we see in the workplace, including in the pay that people receive.
What can we do individually to deal with gender pay and opportunity gaps? And what do workplaces need to do structurally?
When I was a junior lawyer, I intentionally chose the oldest, whitest guy to be my mentor. Those are the power brokers. And so I wanted to be aligned with the person who was going to be doling out work, who could see me doing good work. They're not going to come to you independently unless there is a formal mentorship or sponsorship program. Being creative and finding ways to get in front of the people who do have power, to get them to see that you are competent and qualified. And a lot of the time that takes, you know, initiative. So I remember when I was at my firm, they had partnered us up by gender in terms of our summer student offices. And I noticed this phenomenon happening where if a young man was working with a senior partner, the senior partner would take that young man out to lunch, but he would also take his office mate, who was another young man. I asked them to have more mixed gendered offices. And then I also just went up to that same partner because I was interested in getting to know what he did and said, can I take you out for lunch? It ended up being free lunch for me, but I had to go and put myself in front of him because he wasn't going to see me as easily otherwise. In terms of what workplaces can do, I would say a four-step process. So the first step is to understand the magnitude of this problem. This means data. This means numbers. This means not assuming that you have a good workplace or bad workplace when it comes to these issues, but actually digging into it. You know, where do women start to drop off? Where do women of color start to drop off? What is driving those things? Is it after third year? Is it after fifth year? Is it after 10 years? Is it after you make it to level two in management or you make it to level one in management? Have you done a pay equity audit of your workplace? You know, and not just on salaries, but on bonuses and discretionary payments. You know, how do wages differ between groups who work in similar or same jobs? Then secondly is understanding the barriers, understanding the behaviors and the attitudes. So think of it as like an iceberg. The behaviors are on top, but the attitudes driving the behaviors are the like huge part of ice below. And if you just try and change the behaviors without changing the attitudes, all you're going to get are new biased behaviors. And so thinking about what has stopped people in the past. So one example I like to give to people is I tell them about Jamal versus Charles's resume. Exact resume, you know, Jamal or Greg. Greg gets 50% more callbacks than Jamal. You know, we've known this for 20 years. This research came out, I think, in 2002. And I would ask people if, you know, have you heard about this or are you not surprised by it? Almost all of the hands would go up. Then I would ask them to keep their hands up if their company did anything about this in the hiring process. And almost every single hand would come down. This is not new information, but why isn't anybody doing anything with it or doing anything about it? And I think there's this real element of fear. A woman at a law firm who was directly connected to hiring, you know, I asked her, you know, why don't you use standardized interview questions? Like this didn't seem to me, seemed like a pretty basic thing to do. And she responded, oh, we don't think the students would like it. This is a firm that would get almost 1,000 applications for 15 summer law student spots. They were afraid people wouldn't apply to them. And so I said, okay, you say you're looking for more diverse candidates. Why would you want the people who would be afraid of a standardized question? You say you want diverse candidates. Have you ever considered that they would be more likely to apply to you if they saw that you used standardized questions and found that your process was more fair? You know, someone being afraid of a standardized question is an excellent whittling tool for you. It gets rid of people who are not willing to have a fair process. They want special treatment. The fear that had gone unchecked, no one was examining, is this fear actually based in any reality? A lot of people are afraid that equity is somehow going to cost them. Do you actually lose if Black people are treated more fairly by the police? What do you lose? I don't think you lose anything. And in fact, there's a lot of research that shows that community-based policing leads to safer communities. When you actually treat people with more respect and kindness, your community is safer. You've probably heard that quote 100 times. When you're used to privilege, equality feels like oppression. I'm okay with some people losing because they're the people who should ever have had it in the first place. I'm okay with men 6 through 8 no longer having those opportunities because those are mediocre men who don't deserve them. And men of quality don't fear equality because they know it's not coming for them. If we go to 50-50, the top 50% of men are fine. Step 3 would be interrupting bias. So once you understand the behaviors and the attitudes and the barriers and you understand the magnitude of the problem and you know where your pain points are, maybe do a really great job of hiring and you have a really diverse entering class, but things start to drop off, you know, around middle management. Where can we interrupt that bias that is happening? So when it comes to pay, you know, encouraging pay transparency. I believe there was one organization where when they publish their pay data by department, by race, the next year, all of those pay gaps disappeared. When you were put on blast, you realized, what reason do I have for paying these people differently? And some people were recognizing that some people were being unfairly underpaid. Demanding transparency laws for pay. I believe that the recent requirement that Canada instituted for public sector salary disclosures decreased the gender pay gap at universities from 15% to 4% and led to a lot more female professors getting more raises. Information is power. Like once you find out that Chad, who does not have the master's degree that you do and has 3 years less experience, is being paid more than you, you can go and demand that increase. So I would encourage people who do fall into what we might categorize as more privileged positions to be very open about what you are getting paid. Clarity in their job postings, making sure they have salary ranges, knowing that when women negotiate, they are treated less fairly than when men negotiate. So that can help to reduce what's called that ask gap, which would put women and racialized women at a disadvantage in wage negotiations. And then supporting Black women at work. There was a recent McKinsey Women at Work survey where 77% of the people who responded considered themselves allies at work. But when you ask them to identify the consistent allyship actions they took, those numbers were much lower. So the number who advocated for new opportunities for women of color was only 21%, giving credit to women of color for their ideas and their work, 43%. So nowhere near the 77% that they were claiming. And the number one most important action for women of color is to advocate for new opportunities for women of color. They are competent. They don't need you to boost their competence. They need you to give them the places so they can shine and show that competence. Once you've instituted your bias interrupters, if they don't work, you know, you have to see what's happening at the end. Are they working? Have your numbers shifted? You would never run an ad campaign, just be like, oh, we did it, and not check to see if it had any impact on your sales. And the same thing applies here. So if it didn't work, you have to target a different area if you try a new interrupter, but this is a constant iterative process.
All right, now what? Learn more about gender pay gaps by going to canadianwomen.org. We've got a fact sheet about it, and we just published an infographic with updated statistics for you to share. If you're in Ontario, check out the Ontario Equal Pay Coalition at equalpaycoalition.org. They have great resources, materials, and online petitions to get active on. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give. In the swirl of misinformation and conspiracy theories, how can we stay curious and keep learning? I'm Andrea Gunraj at the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What? A podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Disinformation is defined as false information deliberately intended to mislead. Misinformation is false information shared without intention of misleading. In the digital world in which we live, false information and conspiracy theories, fake news, and downright lies attached to it seems to spread like wildfire. And we're worried about it. A 2022 poll found that people in Canada consider the online misinformation epidemic and climate change as the most serious threats of the modern age. The Government of Canada's online disinformation webpage says it well. Even if you don't believe it, false information causes doubt and confusion. It makes it harder to find factual content you can trust. It also may cause you to delay taking an important decision that could affect your well-being. False information can also continue to influence your beliefs even after you find out it's not true. This effect is known as the continued influence effect, and it's another way that disinformation can cause harm. There's a lot of false information out there when it comes to gender equality and justice issues. We see it all the time on all kinds of issues. The gender pay gap, why we have to unflinchingly confront racism and white supremacy, why ending transphobia and homophobia is a core part of our work, the scope of gender-based violence, misconceptions about trafficking, you name it. Sometimes misinformation leads to genuine questions. Sometimes misinformation leads to accusations and attacks. It's not about the evidence, it's about making a point. And that point may be grounded in discrimination and disempowering marginalized people. What happens when you're faced with some kind of misinformation, no matter how or why it comes? How can you apply your curiosity as a useful tool? This brings me to Sabrina Cruz, co-founder of Answer in Progress. a media production company that encourages people to explore their curiosity and shares every stumble and success along the way. Their YouTube channel is over 1 million subscribers strong, including me, and covers a wide range of topics, from teaching AI to solve the trolley problem to getting good at last-minute gifts. They've collaborated with partners like Google and History. They want to reignite a love of learning in themselves and their audience. Answer in Progress's How Conspiracies Work video addresses the issues of misinformation and curiosity, and it all starts with a conspiracy Sabrina found herself at the center of. Here's a clip of the video to start, by way of background.
Yes, we are on the bed. You could call it an homage to old YouTube. I call it comfortable for my butt. Conspiracy theories. So as somebody who's lost like many a night tumbling down Wikipedia rabbit holes, I love a good conspiracy theory. It's like, ooh, aliens. Ooh, how did people make such big triangles? I think that it's just fun imagining the world to be more interesting than what I was taught. But then something weird happened. A couple weeks ago, I found myself in the middle of a conspiracy theory. And then all of the fun was replaced with just pure confusion. The conspiracy itself is like weird and fun and innocuous. However, what I really cared about is like, how do you get to that point? How do you start seeing signs that were never there to begin with? That's what I want to know. And I also want to like disprove this whole conspiracy theory because it's whack. However, as the person in the middle of all of this, I can imagine why I'd be seen as unreliable. So I'm calling on a friend.
How do you put this? People think that I am part of the Illuminati.
Well, are you?
This is just one of the comments, but I think it really summarizes the issue. I find this channel to be highly disingenuous. Clearly, a corporate product must to have the appearance of an independently run YouTube channel. Person is that skilled at animation, editing, everything presenting, professional for that kid animation takes
There's
decades.
No way this girl is that the one production company put this video together with you just as a host.
So now, now what?
Why am I calling you, right?
Yeah, I'm like, how do you want me to prove this?
I am wondering if you could explain to me and the viewers of this video, how could somebody see something so mundane that's just like a part of my life, I guess? How could somebody see that and think like, there must be more?
I'm interested. I'm fascinated because I'm like, I'm not only interested in your conspiracy, as interesting as it is. I think conspiracies have a knack for, especially nowadays, to just ruin people's lives, you know? I'm gonna solve this mystery. Scooby Dooby Doo.
We don't have the copyright on that.
We're going to investigate this conundrum.
You're doubling down on it, I see.
Hi, I'm Sabrina Cruz. I'm a video producer and the co-founder of Answer in Progress. We're a YouTube channel or digital media production company that tries to take people on the journey from question to answer, showing every struggle and success along the way. Personally, I'm a bit of a jack of all trades kind of person. Like, I'll dive into whatever I find interesting, which is why, like, at some point, I've been wearing glasses my whole life. This is a podcast, but I'm wearing glasses right now. And for the longest time, they would always slip down my face. They'd, like, go down my nose. And that really frustrated me, and I wanted to know why that happened. So I ended up reading, like, 700 years of glasses history to figure out the evolution of glasses and why they ended up being designed the way that they are. And then after I finished that, made a whole video about it, the comments were just like, you could have just gone to an optician. They fixed that for you, which is great. It really is representative of who I am as a person.
You're such a talented content creator. I love Answer in Progress, and I know you've been affected by misinformation yourself. What happened? And what was the connection to bias, racism, sexism, all that bad stuff?
No, first off, thank you very much. And also, racism is bad. I agree. The interesting thing is that there was at one point a conspiracy theory about me for kind of similar reasons. I've been doing this whole YouTube thing since I was a kid. So I've spent a lot of time learning how to write, shoot, host, edit, and animate all of my videos. And like a lot of that was heavily influenced by the heavy hitters in the industry, BuzzFeed, Vox, you know. I like to think that I got quite good at it and I'm still getting better and all of that jazz. But at some point, some weirdos on the internet kind of saw this teen, early 20s girl making these videos that were of pretty decent quality. And then they just naturally assumed, oh, she must be an industry plant. She's just pretending to be an individual, but she's just a host fronting for a real corporation where there are people doing all of the work, which was the most bonkers thing that has ever happened to me, but also kind of a compliment, just also very weird though. When that happened, some people kind of read more into it than I did, maybe. Like, some people thought, oh, this is just because you are a young woman of color. Like, there's no way you could have done this, but they wouldn't have questioned this if somebody else was the one making this stuff. I don't know if that was the case. I talk the way that people who produce those kinds of things talk. I don't blame people for thinking that. And I like to take it as a compliment.
Do you think the problem's getting worse?
It's really tough for me to answer if the problem is getting worse, because like recency bias is a thing and I'm only 24 years old. I haven't experienced that much and I can't tell you what life was like 100 years ago. Maybe it was basically the same. It was just less notification sounds. But in terms of like online misinformation reinforcing these things, reinforcing a lot of bigotry, I think it's just because it's misinformation. We are ultimately shaped by the things we consume, and we do a lot of our consuming online nowadays. I think the thing that might make the internet and social media is that we can feel like we're constantly on display. And so even people with the best intentions might feel pushed to have louder opinions formed faster, and you're less willing to change or update them because it's already been posted for the world to see. It's not like a thought or a conversation you have with friends. There is receipts and screenshots people can pull up. And that might not encourage the best behaviors when it comes down to like staying curious and open-minded and kind. I felt that pressure. I think everybody has felt that pressure. And it's just, it is just really hard to ignore.
What tips and tools would you recommend to help us build our muscles of awareness, curiosity, and critical thinking, and encourage others to do the same?
The tip that I found helped me the most in terms of dealing with all of this mess, the struggles of being alive nowadays, it's slowing down and really understanding who you are as a person and who you want to be. Starting from that foundational point is a good idea because it acts as the basis of your actions and you're the one getting to decide that. There isn't a cure-all. There isn't a single thing you can do to help people and be curious and be thoughtful. But by taking that kind of intentionality to your actions, you're the one deciding it. You put yourself back in the driver's seat rather than like institutional or algorithmic mechanisms that are designed to encourage certain behaviors that you might not want to be doing, but you can't help but do them. That thoughtfulness should be like one of the first steps to take. In terms of actually staying curious and all of that, I think it's always remembering that the people who write things and say things have a goal when they do those things. I have a goal when I publish videos. I want views. I want people to like me. I crave attention. And like being aware of that, like everybody has some sort of intention and you should question them. They're not always bad intentions, but you should be aware of them and think about them and make sure that plays a role in how you internalize information. And then you could always fact check. The internet is vast and it's a bit of a mess sometimes, but you know, there are plenty of resources out there. Wikipedia is surprisingly useful. Google Scholar, you could just search up anything and then type PDF after. And sometimes surprising results show up. Like having multiple sources and like really fact-checking the things that you are choosing to really put a lot of yourself into, it's a good idea.
Any content you'd recommend those of us who want to get curious and keep learning but don't know where to begin? What do you like?
If you want to be curious, there's plenty of stuff that's available. If you like videos, I would recommend Answer in Progress, where we make stuff. But there's also these two podcasts that I'm really enjoying. Let's Learn Everything. They tackle science topics in a really like wholesome and excited way that makes me excited to learn things that I never thought I would have asked. Like they went into the history of the triangle, like the instrument, the triangle, and I was mind blown. And another one is Under Understood, and they tackle internet mysteries, and it just gives me an appreciation for how much life is going on in the world and how many people are just chasing these very niche things. And it's exciting and it's fun, and the world is big and magical, and I think that we should put more time and effort into experiencing that.
All right, now what? Disinformation and misinformation is a huge topic. Websites I go to again and again include Snopes.com and Media Smarts. They're great resources to help you fact-check and get tools to grow your evidence-seeking muscles. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Emma Partridge, and I want to welcome you to a new season of All Right, Now What?, a podcast by the Canadian Women's Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us for our first three seasons, where we explore the pandemic's impact on women and girls. But even when this virus recedes, its impacts will continue to be felt. We still need systemic change to achieve gender equality. So, moving forward, every week our experts will put an intersectional feminist lens on one topic we've all been hearing about. The issues and stories that just seem to keep resurfacing and make you wonder, why is this still happening? How is it possible we haven't fixed this yet? We're going to explore the systemic roots of these issues and real strategies for change. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and the organizations that we support takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Welcome back to a new episode of All Right, Now What? Today, we're going to be talking about a bit of news that we actually generated here at the Foundation. Andrea, what are we talking about today?
Well, we're talking about some work that we did through the Mother Rising campaign that we did around Mother's Day and the month of May. We were looking at really the impact of the pandemic on mothers and family caregivers and the double and triple burden that they're experiencing right now, given all the responsibilities that they have to take on.
So when we talk about the Mother Rising campaign, what did that involve? What did we do and what did we learn?
We had two levels of surveying that we did. We did a poll with our partner, Meru Matchbox, and this was an opinion poll that covered a representative sample of people. And we also did a survey that's an open-ended survey on CanadianWomen.org, allowed anybody to just say what they need to say free form. And what we found with the combination of both is that, of course, mothers and family caregivers are really carrying a heavy load. But we also saw some things around intersectionality. We saw some hints about how different women are experiencing things differently. So I really would like our experts to speak about this in the particular area that we were looking at for this episode.
Yeah, I'm also really looking forward to hearing what our experts have to say about the particular theme that we're addressing today, which is the unequal division of labor in the home. So through this survey, we found that women are still taking on the bulk of caregiving responsibilities, whether that be childcare, elder care, and the pandemic has really worsened and deepened this sort of unequal divide in the home.
And Emma, you've been saying about this in terms of worry work. I really like that term. Because it is emotional labor, and emotional labor is labor. Lots of different people have shown how it's true labor. It's not paid, but it doesn't mean it doesn't take a toll and it doesn't have a cost.
Yeah, that's a term I also really like. I learned that at the start of the pandemic, I want to say around April 2020, Abacus Data came out with the results of a survey that showed that women were taking on the bulk of worry about the pandemic, about COVID. And our survey results really confirm that that sort of unequal division of this emotional labor is still happening, because what we saw in our results is that women not only are still taking on the bulk of childcare and elder care and the sort of administrative caregiving responsibilities of planning their children's life, but also they're much more worried about their family and children's health and their mental health through the pandemic than men are. So here today to talk about why that might be happening and what can be done about it are two of our in-house experts and just two of the coolest women you'll ever meet.
Hi, I'm Anne Dechter. I'm a Senior Director of Community Initiatives and Policy at the Canadian Women's Foundation, which means I work on getting grants out to make change and also on systems change more broadly and the policies that we need to bring about gender equality and equity.
And I'm Karen Campbell, and I'm the Director of Community Initiatives and Policy. I work alongside Anne, and I also do grant making in the areas of economic development and ending women's exploitation.
So our survey that we did with mothers and family caregivers, we're just wondering the results. What did you find that was surprising? Did anything kind of come up for you that might have shocked you or maybe was right in line with what you were thinking?
You know, none of the survey results surprised me all that much. We know that moms and women in general do the lion's share of the caregiving work, and that's the case in normal times. So, of course, this would be amplified in times of stress or crisis. In the survey, we saw that about half of the moms who answered are exhausted. We see that women are worried about reaching their breaking point. They wish that they could have more mental health and well-being supports. And they're generally doing more than their spouses when it comes to managing all of their kids' activities. Although I think one of the things that did stand out for me is that some of the results imply that dads are taking up some more care work in the context of the pandemic than they had in the past. And a good number of them said that they've had to put their careers on the back burner to take up caregiving responsibilities, you know, reducing their work hours. So I think that shows that everybody's had to pitch in more in one way or another, but moms are still carrying the load.
Yeah, I have to agree. I wasn't too surprised. That is a nice point on dads taking up a little more. I think what we're really seeing here is individuals putting individual voices to, you know, the statistics that we've been hearing all along, right? With childcare and schools are, you know, for a parent, they're unreliable. They've been opening and closing and unpredictable. And just way more of that has been happening at home, which has been really, you know, stressing everybody, especially in families where everybody's working from home or unable to work. There's really a lot going on and it's a lot of pressure. And also, I think the word languishing that's been around for the last few weeks or a month in the news, that this is really a description for the mothers of languishing. Like it's basically, it's all too much. I'm worn out. I don't know how much longer I can last, really, kind of thing.
Oh, I've got to read that New York Times article about languishing, because this is like the third person to mention that term in the context of the pandemic to me.
It's a great one because I think languishing is the way that we would describe it in so many different contexts. But thanks, Anne, for mentioning that about moms. It's a particular kind of caregiving languishing that we've been seeing in the data and in our research ourselves. What about your own lives? Is this idea of disparity this something that you've seen in your own families, in your own communities? Karen, any thoughts?
Yeah, I've absolutely both experienced and witnessed this on many levels. You know, my own life is one thing where I'm balancing sort of, you know, my professional work with co-parenting a toddler who really looks to me as his primary parent. So my days are this kind of balancing act that's utterly exhausting, frankly. And, you know, despite the extra effort that my partner has been putting in, it's just the case that is quite tiring. But even more than that, I think about my mom, who for decades balanced her paid work in the healthcare sector with the unpaid care work in our home that allowed my dad and my siblings and me to work and go to school and stay healthy. And in her quote unquote retirement, you know, this unpaid work shifted to caring for my grandfather until he passed away. And now to my 97-year-old great aunt in long-term care. And then comes in the pandemic and now she's taking care of my toddler 4 days a week in the mornings. And, you know, she's in her late 70s. So this is a lifelong thing for her, this unpaid care work that is largely unrecognized in a lot of ways, you know?
I come from a large family. There were six kids. But my father was also a surgeon, so we actually had, at various times, various kinds of paid care in the home, mostly teenagers when we were young, who did various levels of care and various kinds of things. You know, so one got adopted into the family, so it's always a kind of big, you know, a messy kind of thing. But all of that emotional management was my mother's. And my father was kind of free to work all the time and come home and explode. So
emotional management is a great way of describing what mothers, the labor that mothers often do.
And I noticed even like, you know, we were raised, there was three girls, three boys. We were raised, you know, everybody's equal, et cetera. But the emotional work, you know, kind of fell to me as the oldest of the girls in the family.
So let me ask you this question. When we talk about paid and unpaid care work, those tasks that people do without getting paid for them, give us a sense of what they are. What's taking up women's time so much? What's taking up caregivers' time?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. You know, unpaid care work is basically the support work that happens that enables the rest of our economy to run. So it includes things like cooking and cleaning, caring for kids, caring for elderly people, caring for sick people, you know, keeping households running. And it's really about maintaining the health and well-being of people in our communities. And I think that the thing to underline here is that it is work. You know, it requires substantial time, physical and mental effort and emotional investment to get it done. And unfortunately, the fact that it's actually work is often the piece that people forget about.
It harkens back to movements years ago to try and quantify all of that labor and to try and get governments to compensate for it, to count it in the economy. You know, so we've had some movement on that in part because some of it has moved to become paid, like expanding, you know, childcare centers and stuff. So we kind of see it more. And I think, interestingly, we see it in the pandemic because care has been such a huge part of working to make sure people are okay during the pandemic and to end the pandemic. Care has been a gigantic part of that, and we've really seen how it's chronically undervalued. And it remains in that underpaid and undervalued category. Look at the, you know, the long and fairly unsuccessful, in a way, sadly, fight to get 2 weeks paid sick leave so that, you know, care workers are safe and are not, you know, spreading COVID.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing up the 2 weeks pay. So in Canada, provinces and territories have done it very differently across the country. And we saw that the highest I saw was 2 days so far. And it's kind of like we're really resistant to the idea of seeing paid and unpaid care work as valuable, as contributing to the economy, as holding up the economy. So it really speaking to some of the structural things that we have to change.
Yeah, actually, this is a good segue into our next question, because I think it's one thing to say that there's sort of stereotypes about what is deemed women's work and what is dispensable work. But are there any sort of structural or systemic problems that go into, I guess my question is, why are women still taking on the bulk of this work? Are there any other reasons that we haven't mentioned yet?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, actually, to point out that there are stereotypes. And, you know, there is that piece about how we're socialized, right, from a very young age. It is the norm in societies to see care work as the women's domain. And women and men internalize these social expectations, right? So even in heterosexual relationships where partners see themselves as equals, you know, women still tend to do more of the care work. But you're right, too, that structurally there are lots of structures that hold that up. And, you know, we started talking about it earlier in the context of the pandemic, you know, for working moms with partners, they've had to do some pretty basic calculations, right? Who earns more? Whose job is more secure? that's the person who's going to continue working while the other parent takes up the care work in the home. And the person who stays home after that calculation is almost always the mom, which makes these longstanding gender pay gap and gendered inequities in the workforce, you know, even worse. And we see that this is particularly bad for Black, Indigenous, and racialized women who are concentrated in the lower paying sectors and positions.
Yeah, Karen really hit that right on the nose. That's exactly really what happens. And, you know, I think over the lifetime of a family, it doesn't actually make sense. This is not an economy in which you can have one high earning partner and one who doesn't work for almost everybody. That is not going to work. And even the GDP, the growth of GDP over the last 20 years has really been from the increase of women in the workforce. We need to keep that up. And we need to start valuing care and service work. Economists, this has been an economic topic for a long time, that it's the production of goods. That's the measure of your economy. And it's simply not where we are anymore in the world, right? We there's service industries, tech, all of these things. It's not about producing goods. It's about supplying services. And we need to start to measure that. And then we need all the other things to shift based on that.
So our measures are a little old. It seems that our thinking is old. Things that also we have some, you know, reversion of some progress that we've seen. What do you feel the effect is going forward? We have young people who are seeing things really modeled in a way that perhaps could deepen some of the stereotypes and deepen some of the feelings around, well, this is women's work and this is men's work. This is not appropriate for me. This is appropriate for you. Do you think that that's an impact that we have to think about going forward as this pandemic has been more than a year and will probably continue for a while longer, certainly in terms of its reverberations? Karen, any thoughts?
I think about that a lot because I have a little boy at home, you know, and we know that like gender inequality is bad for everybody. We know that these gender stereotypes lock in really young, really quickly, and they affect kids' sense of self from a really young age. You know, we know that kids start to classify jobs and activities and toys and all of these ways, right, as specifically male or female. And thinking too about non-binary and trans kids who are subject to bullying and have worse mental health outcomes than cisgender kids. So there's all kinds of, you know, impacts that this kind of thinking has. You know, and you often hear people try to think about this at the household level, right? Like, and say, you know, you need to teach your kids in a different way. But when we think about that at the household level, we really risk turning this into a question of, you know, personal relationships and parenting styles, putting the responsibility back into families to upend these really entrenched gender roles that our society expects. And, you know, there's certainly a role for that kind of education and for, you know, families to model gender equality in the home and push back against those stereotypes. But, you know, the structural changes that need to happen to make this kind of equality a reality in the household and to make it a social expectation is the real work that needs to happen. So a good example of this could be making sure that, you know, all parents, not just those who give birth, you know, can take parental leave without economic penalties or without social penalties, right? When a dad is going to take a long parental leave, you know, what does that how is that received by his colleagues and you know, what implications are there for him? So I think there's work to be done on that structural piece.
The most successful strategy that has been documented on trying to shift gender roles has been the use it or lose it parental leave for the second partner. And in Quebec, they brought it in at not your, you know, EI, here's a paltry portion of what you usually make. They brought it in at a higher salary matching level. And that really has been the most successful strategy to actually get the second parent, generally father, to take a year. As Karen says, there's all these larger factors, right? Like the gender pay gap. That's always going to influence that and what happens socially. But I always come back to thinking about, you know, the success of women in education and how that's just going to continue to force change. Maybe it's really gradually, but, you know, women surpassed men in university education back in 1990. And by 2013, 2015, we're more educated across the population. So I kind of hang my hat on, there's only so long we're going to continue to undervalue that workforce if it's actually a better educated workforce. And so you have that, but you still have these huge gaps in lots of places. And generally, the closer you get to power, the bigger the gap for women and racialized women in particular, and racialized men as well.
I really like that phrase, the closer you are to power, the wider the gap becomes, because I think those working in the sector have known for some time that the gender wage gap is just sort of a fact of the workforce in Canada, and it doesn't necessarily diminish based on your education level or based on the industry that you're in. But it's been maybe a struggle to get people to believe that. And then new data out of StatsCan just last month indicated that women in executive roles actually make 56% less than men in executive roles. And for racialized women, or that gap is even wider. So we're talking about highly educated, high achieving women who are still experiencing a gap at a really substantial rate. Obviously, this inequality is deeply baked into our systems and structures. But just going back to the level of social conditioning and the level of the individual a little bit, I'm sure we've all seen or heard in our lives people making arguments that, oh, they chose to become a mother, and therefore the sort of struggles that they face as mothers shouldn't be framed around this language of inequality. If they've made a choice to have this be a part of their identity, the challenges that they're facing don't have to do with systemic inequity. And I guess, what would you say to those people?
Wrong. There's a lot wrong with that statement. I think it's a good question, because when moms point out the struggles that they're having, particularly in the context of the pandemic, you're right that the world is really quick to remind them of two things. One, that her children are a blessing. And second is that she signed up for this, right? And, you know, it's so steeped in judgment. And, you know, that's sort of where my eye rolling comes in. However it is that somebody becomes pregnant or decides to have children is really none of anybody's business. And that decision really has no bearing on whether or not an injustice is occurring when that mother is not treated equally to others. You know, the injustice arises when that mother experiences discrimination and unequal treatment, as we see in the disproportionate care responsibilities that she carries. And very simply, you know, this care burden that we're talking about, it actually prevents them from being able to participate in society in general equally.
Speaking of dads, a lot of people have wondered, you know, what about their share? And are they also stressed out? In some of our survey results, we saw that dads were also, to a lesser degree, feeling angry, hopeless, sad, upset. Let's talk about what we need to do to look at them and their role. What, first of all, are they experiencing? And then secondly, how can we encourage them to take on some of these care work roles that will balance things out and make everybody, hopefully everybody in the family, feel a little bit more supported?
Yeah, no, I think I said it off the top too, right? Like in the pandemic, everybody's pitching in, everybody's doing more work. And it's really hard for everybody. And I don't at all want to diminish that, you know, that extra role that everybody has to take on here. It's just that the numbers really point to the massive implications of what's happening for women and for moms in Canada right now. So while fathers may also be overworked and tired and stressed out as a population of dads, right? They're not the ones who are experiencing a rollback of 30 years of gender equity gains. And as a group, they're more likely to come through this with fewer long-lasting negative impacts on their lives and livelihoods than moms are. So I think it's important to acknowledge that everybody needs additional supports at this time, you know, income supports for people whose, you know, jobs have been affected, mental health supports for people who are, you know, struggling to balance all of this. But I think we just need to really keep our focus on those who are struggling the most and who are most likely to get left behind in the recovery. And that particularly means Black, Indigenous, and racialized women and gender diverse folks and those who are moms.
Yeah, so as we wrap here, I was wondering if we could maybe end on a note of hope. I think we've made some allusions to the federal budget and the investments that were made in childcare there. Are there anything, is there anything else in Canada's response to the pandemic and to specifically this unequal division of labor in the home that is kind of giving you hope? Or is there some things that you wish the response maybe contained that it doesn't?
The childcare promise gives me lots of hope. It is really a huge investment. And the idea of having a national affordable childcare system is that's really a game changer for mothers, for families, and really for the economy too, you know, like getting women through this and into a recovery where childcare is possible for them is a huge, huge thing. And we need more like that, you know. The other piece is around the National Action Plan to End Gender-Based Violence, which is another important investment promise that
afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.